Today's show is a conversation I had with Dwayne David Paul, co-founder of Religion in Revolt, a digital platform for the liberation work of faith communities.
For starters, I asked myself, what are the conditions necessary for human flourishing, for sort of happiness broadly construed? And I imagine liberation as a world full of that, with ready access to those things.
Welcome to What in God's Name. We're talking today with Dwayne David Paul. Dwayne is a writer, educator, and community organizer. He is co-founder of Religion in Revolt, a digital platform that aims to develop and promote the liberation work of faith communities. I want to explain this to our listening community. I came across Dwayne's writing first in America magazine. This prompted me to track him down on the amazing internet, and Dwayne's got a lot of writing out on the internet that you can find. And so I extended an invitation to him for this conversation on One in God's Name. And I'm very grateful to Dwayne for generously accepting my invitation. So Dwayne, we like to get our listening community grounded in who we're talking to. And I know, based on my research, you've got an interesting story to tell about your own journey. So give us, if you would, the story of how you have arrived at the work that you're doing. How did you get to where you are?
Hi, Chris. Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I was a really curious child, and I'm always drawn in some sense to theology, religious studies, mythology. And so that had its hooks in me really early. And I was quite fortunate that my mom and my grandmother and even my I'm Catholic. And so my religious education teachers, you know, they were all very welcoming of my curiosity. And I, you know, maybe a generation or two of Catholics before me would have gotten a very different response to some of the questions that I asked, but all my folks were just like, oh, it's a great question. I don't know. You should look that up. Right. And so, you know, I was very fortunate in that regard. Yeah. And so I was pretty sure that this was what I wanted to study when I went to college. I was all set in terms of, you know, picking a major in college and studying philosophy and theology. And, you know, I think I'm 37. And so I graduated into, you know, I walked across the stage as Lehman Brothers was crumbling, and you know, my sort of educational formation was happening against the backdrop of, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as a high school student, and of course as a college student, Katrina, the Great Recession, you know, all this was happening as I was studying. And, you know, I was experiencing, when I got to graduate school, I experienced some personal loss in my family. And that really got me curious, or really sort of put in doubt the value of what I was doing. You know, I am grateful for the education I received, and I still return to those resources. But the sort of vision of theology that I received as an undergraduate was very much apart from, you know, what was happening in society. I went to a Jesuit college, St. Peter's University. And so that wasn't what I received in, say, campus ministry, but theologically it was sort of grounded very much in as sort of a part. And so when I, you know, all this is happening by the time I get to graduate school, you know, Occupy, the wars, the recession, my studies felt like a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, and I couldn't, you know, I hadn't really sort of read a lot or much of any theology that was sort of very much encountered with, you know, the world and working people's problems, and poor people's problems. And so I was like, well, I love me some Augustine, but this sure does feel it feels like a really weird, the basement of the library feels like a really weird place to be with the world burning, you know? And so, you know, I went through with my studies, You know, I sort of just continued, but very quickly tried to figure out, you know, how I could be useful to communities I care about. And, you know, engaged in ministry. I traveled. I engaged in ministry with students, you know, doing sort of social justice education, directed an advocacy organization for the last 4 years. And in the course of that, coming back to like writing theology, ironically, became a part of my work.
So one piece of this I just want to pursue for a second because it's so interesting is the image you gave me, the very strong mental image of being in the basement of the library while the world burns. And that to me, that's just an incredibly powerful image of, I think, yeah, how does study, academic study, how does it not be just academic? And I feel like the work that you do, the writing that I've read of yours is, I feel like you're constantly asking yourself that question. How do the words that I write for these various publications and the work that I do connect theology, some kind of theology, it doesn't have to be Augustine, but some kind of theology with what's really happening? Is that a fair assessment?
For sure. And for the record, I still love me some Augustine.
Good, because I do too. I was a little afraid, like, I was like, well, there's a lot of Augustine we could really talk about here. So I'm glad to hear you say
yeah,
that.
Yeah. You know, I had the, you know, I had the most, like, I had the most, like, dead white man kind of education. Yeah. And I loved it. I still love it.
Yeah, don't you didn't you study classics at some point?
Yeah, so that was, I minored in classics, and so I read a ton of Greek tragedy, and that's still really important to me. A ton of Augustine, a ton of Plato, a lot of Dostoevsky, and I still love it. And you know, but you know, to the question of like, how do we, you know, sort of put our theology in contact with public life, and political life and the struggles of everyday people. I do think that, some of that has to be through practice, right? Like I do think that you have to be tethered to a community that is struggling, and not struggling as in having a hard time, but engaged in sort of political, struggle. Yeah. And that doesn't mean, because I think one might hear that and think, oh, well, I don't have the time for that, right? Like I'm working for, but I didn't say that, you know, the writer, the theologian, you know, the philosopher, whoever, has to lead these struggles, right? I don't think you have to be on the tenure track and leading a political organization. You can be a rank and file member just like anybody else. Right. Like your fatigue isn't any more special than the fatigue of, you know, the housekeepers organizing the hotel union. You know, your fatigue isn't any more special than the janitors union, you know, like the brothers and sisters showing up, you know, in these universities in many cases, organizing like their own union, or whatever the case may be. Right. And so I do think like morally, I think as a matter of integrity, right? Like you have to be attached to some sort of, you know, some sort of activity, some sort of organization. But then I think even aside from that, like how do you know what you're talking about? What could possibly be the substance of your engagement? You know, and that, you know, that's not, again, that's not to say like one is sort of better than the other, right? Sort of practical wisdom versus sort of theoretical wisdom. But I think like if you're not doing that, and perhaps it's like a more like meta discussion, if you're not doing that, you're essentially just like a literary critic, right? You're sort of engaging the literature of your field that talks about this thing, liberation or freedom or whatever, but not engaged in sort of practical reflection, right? And so how does the theologian, how does the philosopher, how does the political theorist not sort of, I don't want to say just like in a derogatory sense, but how do you not just be a literary critic discussing the literature of your field where the subject is this sort of thing called freedom or liberation or justice or whatever. And the answer is practice.
Where did you get the metaphor of the literary critic? Because that reminds me of Timothy Snyder at Yale. The Yale historian actually uses that very same metaphor of literary critic as kind of the one removed from and not a creative agent, but rather the deconstructor. And so taking the easy stance of tearing down rather than building up. I was curious. I'm asking the question because I'm curious if you know Tim Snyder's work at Yale, and I'm led to that because you use that metaphor of the literary critic.
Yeah, that's something that sort of come to me within the last like 6 to 9 months. You know, I've been trying to answer the question of like, what is the task of religion and revolt, and what is my task, sort of my own task as a writer. And that was sort of one answer, right? Where it's like, well, if I'm not attached to some sort of organization, like, what am I actually doing? And that was sort of one answer. Well, I'm just engaging with, you know, with other people's books, and they're also just sort of engaged with other people's books. You know, it's like the image in the trial in Kafka, where he, like, you know, the protagonist goes into the church and is like, well, hold on, let me, like, what does the sacred book say? And then it's like, oh, hold on, let's get the commentary on the commentary. You're just sort of like in this, like, you know, epistemic loop, right? What is it tethered to?
Yeah. And I want to turn to religion and revolt. I just have a brief rejoinder to this, because it's, to me, it's not simply epistemological, although it is that, but there's also a theology of incarnation involved too, which calls us to encounter embodied people, because our theology says that we're not just spirit, right? That the whole human is an embodied human. So anyway, that's an aside, a little theological riff to toss in there. But let me pivot to religion and revolt, because I do want to hear you talk more about that project. You know, I've said to you in preparation for our conversation today that our essential question on One in God's Name for this program season is, what are the moral foundations of democracy? It's a question that allows not just for many justifiable answers, but for a lot of justifiable approaches as well. It's a question that can be parsed, I am learning, in a lot of different ways. So one of the ways that I want to approach this question is by asking you about religion and revolt. And in doing so, I don't mean for you to talk about the moral foundations of democracy in relation to religion and revolt. I think it'll emerge. I just want you to talk about religion and revolt, your online platform. And so the question is this: liberation. The word liberation, the concept of liberation, seems to be a key idea for religion in revolt. And I would love to invite you to do a little theological, philosophical riff on how you see and understand liberation and how that animates your work.
Sure. Thank you for that. For starters, I asked myself, what are the conditions necessary for human flourishing, for sort of happiness broadly construed? And I imagine liberation as a world full of that, with ready access to those things. And it's the latter that we're working on. You know, I think our productive capacity economically and sort of, you know, in terms of like manufacturings and goods, we've actually reached like a really high level of productive capacity, right? Where like we generally speaking can have and do and enjoy a lot, but so few people actually own those goods and control those goods and have ready access to them. That to me is a huge problem, right? Where we have so much food and we produce so much food, but so many people are hungry. We have such great technology, technology that can do so much, that can, but so much is ordered towards the profit of the few and the gain of the few. And I won't say the flourishing of the few, because I don't think that you are actually sort of flourishing in a holistic sense, you know, as an exploiter, as an expropriator of resources and of goods and of human labor and time. So, yeah, I mean, I think collective liberation is both being in sort of right relationship with one another and with nature, and of having the conditions and having sort of ready access to the conditions that make that possible, and then also make it easier for people to be good and pro-social. Does that make sense? I hope that's clear.
It makes more than it does more than make sense. So I will give you my granular response to this, which is as a follow-up question in preparation for your answer to that question. My follow-up question that I prepared ahead of time was liberation from, liberation for. Like, I thought, I anticipated a possible, one possible answer to my question would have been a litany of things that oppress people and keep people down. And you did give that, but you framed it in the with the first in mind, which is liberation for. What are we free for? What do we want? What is the positive vision? And so I loved, resonated with, was writing down as you were speaking and then missed something because I was writing down. But you said human flourishing, and then you said something else, and then you said happiness broadly construed. And to me, that's what I hold in response to your answer. And I'm grateful that you framed it that way. I guess I would say you can have a rejoinder to this. Sometimes in these kinds of conversations, I feel like something important is missing because I feel like conversations about social justice can get really bogged down into just the litany of oppressions without the positive vision. So anyway, I don't need to comment further on that. That's my subjective experience. So the follow-up question, now where do I go? I've got a zillion questions written on my page. Let's go here for a second. So talking a little bit more about religion and revolt, and I had a question for you about coalition building, because I think it's pretty clear that our society doesn't have that vision that you outlined, a vision of flourishing for the whole. So related to the question I want to ask is, perhaps I'd be curious to hear about your theory of change. Like, how is this going to change? And so that's, you can bracket that one off for a second. If I think about that, I think about building coalitions. So here's a question for you. What's your experience of the anti-religious political left? So people who actually, they're not just neutral about religion in the public square, they're actively against religion being engaged in public conversations and would like to see religion sidelined or keep it privatized. Just wouldn't it all be better if all those religious voices would go away? So to me, there's an interest here because there's certainly potential allies in the political left, but there's a segment of the political left that probably doesn't want to have anything to do with religion and revolt and what in God's name. So I'm curious about that. Any experiences you have or thoughts about it?
So two things, you know, two thoughts. One is, I think that is an understandable sort of reaction to sort of Western religion and organized religion more broadly, right? But I do think it ends up being an inadvertently kind of conservative position, right? Because, like, you know, so like I said, you know, I'm Catholic. And so in these situations or sort of in these thought experiments, I ask, like, well, who's the Catholic Church? Right? And who is the church? Who is the religion or that you're reacting against, right? Is it my working class grandma who's praying for us right now? Or is it the bishop? Because they both make a claim on, you know, on Catholic, right? Uh-huh. And I the reaction is to the latter, right? And I think we have to be careful that, like, in reacting to that, that we don't alienate the former. Not only sort of we don't alienate, and this is why I think it's conservative, it's a concession, right, that the bishop is the church. Because you don't have beef with my grandma or, like, the aunties on my block, you know, who have rosaries in their pockets or, like, and, like, praying between loads of laundry. That's not who you have a beef with. And so why concede the title to the bishop, right, or to the hierarchy and sort of fill in the blank for whatever religious affiliation? And, like, I'm still Catholic out of spite, right? Like, I'm just, like, annoyed that, like, it's largely self-selecting, right? Where, like, people aren't, like, yeah, there's no, like, reformation coming. You know, people are just like, yeah, you know, no, and just leave, understandably. And so out of spite, I'm just sort of sticking around. And also because, like, I like, you know, going to mass with my grandma. And so, like, that's one thing, right, where it's in a kind of an inherent, like, concession to the sort of hierarchy or the power brokers, whatever that sort of polity looks like in, you know. And then, like, another thing is a reflection from, like, Kwame Ture, right, formerly known as, like, Stokely Carmichael, who was organized with Dr. King and then split off and was a, you know, lead thinker of the Black Power movement. You know, was also understanding, like, some of that, not all of it, some of that is sort of universalizing, you know, European. Because if you're organizing and you're trying to be effective, are you going to go into the Bronx? You know, you're going to, like, organize some, like, aunties and say, all right, drop all the God stuff. And, you know, it's like, you're not organizing anybody doing that, right? Like, you're not, you know, like, you're not coming into Brooklyn or Hartford or whatever and saying that and also thinking you're going to be effective. And so part of our work is, like, meeting people where they're at. We, you know, we also need to sort of be aware of, like, you know, where we're at and, like, and our audience. And I say that, and I don't want to dismiss, like, sort of real, like, religious trauma and, like, harm that people have experienced.
Let me ask you, since you brought up Augustine, not me, let me ask you this. I've been thinking hard in the last, not just a little bit, so not for a long time. So you can help me out on this. Justice and love. I mean, Augustine talks about ordered loves and desiring the good. Okay, have you, I mean, this could be a fruitless avenue, so tell me if it's fruitless, but do you have any thoughts about the relationship of justice and love? Niebuhr had stuff to say about this, and I think a lot of Christian ethicists do as well. I think the question behind the question for me is, I alluded to it a little bit earlier when you responded to my question about liberation, which is sometimes, I would just give you my gut reaction sometimes to conversations that focus simply on justice, which is they leave me cold a little bit. But aside from my personal reaction, I wonder if there's something deeper going on in our society that might be illuminated if we talked more about love as a virtue in a democratic polity or in a polity that aims to be self-governing. And I guess what I mean by that is, or here's what I wonder. Does justice talk make any sense or can it gain any traction in a society if there isn't, prior to justice talk, a basic stance of the word love, but caritas, just care, just basic human care. That's my question. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Okay. So on the I think like the virtue stuff has to take place within the sort of context of how society is ordered, because I'm super into like virtue ethics. But I do think like the problem is that we end up talking about virtue ethics. We end up talking about virtue almost like divorced from society, right? And the moral subject as a kind of almost like purely metaphysical subject. And so like, how do we talk about, you know, how do we talk about, right? Like the sort of quiet part, for instance, and sometimes not even quiet part of sort of virtue ethics conversations as it's taken place historically, is that these were largely like aristocrats talking about the life of like other aristocrats, right? And so like, you know, so the good life and the sort of good person and the virtuous person, they weren't imagining, you know, the slave or the peasant work in the field for 12 hours. Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, these were all aristocrats, right? But I do think like, you know, when we sort of, and a part of my initial answer was like, how do we create the conditions under which like it is easier and more likely for the virtuous person to thrive? You know, it is harder to be less violent, right? These are predictable adaptations to conditions. And so if we have the capacity, we should transform the conditions such that it is easier to engage, to have pro-social values and behaviors. And you know, and so here I do want to, you know, there's a lot of like really wonderful abolitionist, contemporary abolitionist literature and feminist abolitionist literature that centralizes care. To sort of, you know, close the loop on that thought, like, what does it mean to like to tell someone to be like loving and generous, you know, when they're barely making ends meet? And so with Augustine, why I haven't abandoned Augustine is I love me some hellfire and brimstone, right? I just think historically it's been directed at the wrong people. So let's talk about disordered love and disordered attachments when like, you know, what does it mean to have $1 billion? That's a ridiculous thing, right? Like that's an insane kind of way to live, right? And not only to have $1 billion, but to have $1 billion when your countrymen are starving, right? When the fastest growing homeless population is 50 and above right now in the United States, right? What does it mean to sort of gobble up properties when the elderly are like dying on the street? That to me is a profoundly disordered love, and we need some of that hellfire and brimstone rhetoric for the owners of those things, right? Like that's the problem.
Dwayne, thank you for that. That was a much better answer than I expected. Not that I wouldn't expect a great answer from you, but I think you led me to places I didn't expect to go. Let me put it that way. And so two brief things as a rejoinder. I loved a couple of things in what you said, especially that I want to talk about. But one is your parsing of virtue ethics as kind of an aristocratic exercise. And I simply wanted to point out, and it's fresh on my mind because I'm reading this now, but Jeffrey Stout, who was at Princeton, has a book called Democracy and Tradition, and you may know it, you may not, but basically his argument is that there is now a tradition of basically virtue ethics articulated in a democratic tradition. And he points to, in the American context, he points to Emerson and then Whitman and then Dewey. There's a kind of an American pragmatism also involved in that. So, and you kind of alluded to that, not in specifically, but as you were painting that, and this is the second thing I want to say, is you were painting this picture of fire and brimstone for the disordered desires that are manifest in our society right now. You know, yes, it comes across as naive to just say, okay, let us find a social love that will just move us to create policies where there's a fairer distribution of wealth in our country. That's ridiculous. That will never happen. And I think what, at least my understanding of a piece of what Religion in Revolt is doing, your project is doing, is recognizing that those who have power, and this is the fire and brimstone part, those who have power are not just going to give it up because somebody says we should have more social compassion. Mm-hmm. The pressure has to be brought. And I think that is tied also to a particular view of human nature that Augustine would that Augustine yeah. would articulate, right? We're sinful. And those of us who have power want to keep it. So those are my rejoinders. Do you want to rejoin to my rejoinder, or should we pivot? Because I do have a Baldwin question I want to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to, because I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned, like, you know, creating a social love that, you know, would be in favor of more equitable policies. Not an exact quote, but I think, like, a part of the fight is to do the inverse, right? To create policies under which that sort of social love can
thrive.
And this was a thing that, like, I am, you know, incredibly fascinated by. You know, you read Frederick Douglass, his first autobiography, and this is you know, kind of true, you know, of many slave narratives coming out of the Americas in the 19th century. They speak so much about the corrupting influence of the institution of slavery on both the enslaved and the enslaver. And that, I think, is a part of where, like, the social forces, the social structures, I would also add the, like, economic and productive. I don't think there's a way for, I think there are, like, corrupting of the human heart, you know, like, I think it's impossible, you know, to exist in an exploitative relationship and not be, like, brutalized and deranged by that on both ends. And that's where the sort of virtue ethics kind of comes in for me. We don't live under conditions, you know, we live in conditions where it is incredibly difficult, you know, to relate to one another justly. And this is a thing from, like, Frederick Douglass. This is, I think, like, Amy Césaire's point in Discourse on Colonialism, you know, where he's talking about, like, the corrupting influence of colonization on the colonizer, right? How white people have been brutalized by dominating the earth and other human beings. And I think that can't be spoken of enough, right? So yeah, that end of my rejoinder.
That is a perfect pivot to Baldwin, really, because he is so strong on that very point, the dehumanization of the one who dominates, the deformation of the one who dominates. So, Dwayne, I read recently Eddie Gloud's book on James Baldwin. Eddie Gloud, mm-hmm. Begin Again, his reading of James Baldwin. And here's what Eddie Gloud has to say. What I'm about to read reconnects or connects in a different way to some of the themes we've really been opening up here. So this is Eddie Gloud's words. He says, by 1967, Baldwin saw how appeals to morality could seem entirely unacceptable for young people hardened by the country turning its back on the movement. Of course, by 1967, this is Chris talking now, right? By 1967, all these assassinations have happened. That realization did not change the fact that a moral sickness lay at the heart of the country's malaise. While America's choice to remain racist made black power necessary, the black power movement, He, Baldwin, worried about the turn to separatism. No matter what happened, we were and would always be American. I mean, Gloud's reading of Baldwin is that Baldwin is always seeing the moral dimension, and I think that is true. Not moralistic, but moral. The connections or disconnections between people and what is due to people and what is fair, which is a form perhaps of love. But Gloud is happy to point out, or appropriately points out, that for some people, like at a certain point, just talking about morality is not sufficient. He says it became unacceptable for young people hardened by the country's turning its back. So here's the question. For young people, does moral talk just kind of just seem like a lot of hot air, like just not, I mean, you can't speak for all young people, I understand, but just in the circles you run with, like is moral categories, moral vision, moral talk, is it just a bunch of air?
So I guess I'll start with, you know, the reaction, you know, then Stokely Carmichael, but, you know, he died as Kwame Ture. You know, I think he summarized it pretty clearly, right? He said, like, you know, if a white person, like, wants to lynch me, that's their problem. If they have the power to lynch me, that's mine. And so I am, on the one hand, right, as a religious person and as someone who's, like, coming out of that sort of formation, that language, sort of morality, is still really important to me. But I think divorced from an analysis of power, I think is, like, deeply suspicious because, for starters, like there's not really been like a moral conversion in the United States, right? Like we just kind of the subjects sort of the civil rights movement and the subjects of the sort of great moral awakening supposed just sort of died out from public discourse, right? Uh-huh. Like we didn't solve segregation. Scholars, by and large, sort of mainstream media outlets just sort of stopped talking about it. At a certain point, the sort of depoliticized like moral discussions is just sort of asking for me to be a sucker, because there has to be substance, right? There has to be a thing to point to.
Yeah, thanks for that answer. I think that's illuminative to me, and I think it's just perceptive, which means I think it's just true. I think what you've said is just true. Eddie Gloud says he's very much along your lines with regards to the segregation talk just kind of disappeared. And he points to Reagan's election in 1980 as the moment when that, you know, that was the close of that moment. And which is why he titles his book, Begin Again. Eddie's call is, as we aim at the ideal of a more perfect union in this self-governing democracy or democratic republic or however you want to term it, as we aim towards that more perfect union, it has these times in Eddie's perspective where we have to begin again. And he's basically saying now is another time that we have to begin again. I resonate with, and I'm always grateful to be reminded, bring to consciousness the necessity of being suspicious of power and asking where the power is, and is power using virtue talk or morality talk to basically hide or to end the conversation in some way. So
yeah, and it's it never seems to be sort of directed at power. And so I sort of frequently like sort of relative power, like among groups, and sort of more broadly, right? Like, so I joke that, you know, all of my writing is, you know, about the preferential option for the poor, you know, which as a sort of baseline is three sets of claims. One, that God has a special love for those who are marginalized and oppressed. So a theological claim, an ethical claim that we are meant to emulate that love, that special love, in our interpersonal dealings. And then three, like a political or communal claim that we're to order our society in such a way and strive for a society in such a way that manifests that love. And to me, that's sort of it, right? Like, that's the whole thing. And that's moral stuff, right? And that makes a demand on us. But it's also like a kind of like realpolitik, right? It's not naive because the needs of the vulnerable are broadly construed human needs, right? And so a society organized around human needs that puts it at the center, you know, is a sober one, right? It recognizes that, for instance, we need to, we ought to, not only is this a moral ought, it's also a prudent ought, right? To organize society around, you know, in a way that, like, for instance, disabled people can flourish, because I'm a frail human and I'm eminently like disableable, right? Like, I could be disabled. I could leave my house, right? And we ought, so morally, right, for people who are vulnerable right now, we ought to organize that. But it's also just prudent, right? Because we could be. But that is sort of rarely, rarely included in sort of the moralizing that is done publicly, because it's always saying to the single mom that you're a bad person. Speaking of Reagan, right? That you're a bad person, that you're a leech, right? It's not that, you know, the landlord or the owner, you know, who is exploiting you and having you live in rundown conditions. That person, for some reason, is never a leech, even though by definition, you know, they live off of dividends, and they live off of not their labor, but our labor and the value that it reproduces.
We need to come to an end. And I was thinking, our essential question is, what are the moral foundations of democracy? You've alluded to this. I was thinking, well, we haven't really addressed that directly, but we've addressed it like all throughout this conversation. It's really been that kind of conversation. So I will say again, Dwayne, I'm so very grateful for your time. I'm curious if there's anything that you want to take this last opportunity to say or to add.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I sort of landed in terms of centralizing the needs of, you know, those who are vulnerable, that's sort of it. And I think that is those are the conditions under which democracy is sort of actually possible. You know, how do we organize society in which, like, democratic practice is not only possible, but meaningful? So, yeah. So thank you. And this was awesome.
Yeah. I've so enjoyed talking with you, Dwayne. We've talked today with Dwayne David Paul. Dwayne is a writer, educator, and community organizer. He is co-founder of Religion in Revolt, a digital platform that aims to develop and promote the liberation work of faith communities. We will include the website for Religion in Revolt in our show notes. Yeah, Dwayne, it was... Again, I've said it a million times, but I can't say it enough. Thank you for spending some time with me and with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
If you like what you've heard today, and you like what the What in God's Name Project is doing, please consider sponsoring our work for less than $1 a week on Patreon. It's barely any money for you, but it means a lot to us. And so we thank you.